During an extraordinary year, when a worldwide crisis required everyone to pivot in their personal and professional lives, and their team faced unprecedented challenges, Habitat for Humanity Tucson held true to the values they were founded on more than 40 years ago. They believe everyone deserves a decent place to live. They pulled together and faced each day with new enthusiasm and open hearts. However, we are still facing an unprecedented housing crisis. Stay with me to find out just what this great organization is up to and learn about some of the things that they're doing to mitigate this crisis. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Down to Earth Tucson. So I'm not only excited about our guests today, I continue to be amazed by the work being done in our community by the organization he represents. So please join me in welcoming Gordon Yarrington. He is the Chief of Retail Operations, Habitat for Humanity, Tucson. And I have to say, his story is really a good one, and I want to tell just a little bit about it before we dive in. After a 30-year career in real estate sales and 12 years as a volunteer and board member of Habitat for Humanity, Tucson, Gordon agreed to sit in as interim executive director for a six-week period. It cracked me up when I read that was 7 years ago. He's like the thing that couldn't leave, and we didn't want him to. So Gordon has held most every leadership position at the organization and is currently going into halftime retirement, which I'm trying not to hold against him, as the Chief of Retail Operations. Welcome, Gordon. It took us a while for you to finally get here, but we did it, and I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, thanks, Gina. I appreciate being on today, and you and I have been friends for a while, and it's a pleasure to finally do this together.
Thank I know. You. I had a big smile on my face prepping. It's like, yay, Gordon's finally on. And right. it's so relevant what you're here to talk about. Fortunately for us and the content of this show, we're going to talk about a housing report and four big takeaways. And for 2021, I think it's really important. And as I said in the intro, during an extraordinary year, Habitat really stood up to be counted big time. And I know that because there were still bills and things were done in COVID-compliant ways. And I also want to add that in addition to those unprecedented challenges around the COVID-19 pandemic, there have been consistent outcries for racial justice, and intensified storms and wildfires have seriously tested our nation, our community, elevating housing insecurity so big time, racial discrimination in housing, and the critical link between health and home. It's made front page news, and I hope it keeps making front page news. So to that end, Harvard University did a report, State of the Nation's Housing. It was a great report and a lot of reveals. And one of the first reveals was persistent unaffordability. Certainly sure that was no shock to you. So tell us about what the report revealed.
Well, the report really is great because the pandemic in general put a real microscope on this problem of housing affordability and racial injustice. Right now, Gina, there are in 2019 there were 37.1 million households were experiencing housing cost burden. They were spending, which means that they're spending 30% of more of their income on housing. And actually, this represents 30.2% of all households nationwide. That's one out of seven households. 17.6 million people in total were severely burdened by spending half or more of their income on housing. So this is a persistent problem in the nation, and it's really one of the reasons that Habitat was founded and Habitat exists, because we're really trying to address that issue of affordability in housing.
And Gordon, I just want to ask everybody to press pause here. We talk about this a lot in our family. And the reason why I was able to start every business that I have, which there have now been five, all successful, all still going, is because we had a house and we borrowed on the house. We got a second mortgage. I'm not recommending that to everyone. It worked out for me. But it was so not a burden. We had equity. And had I not had that, well, maybe Mrs. Green wouldn't be here. That would be really sad. But my point is, sitting where I sit, knowing that I have, you know, white privilege, that I have worked hard, that's true. But to know housing is a key to the core of American success, in my opinion. And it's absolutely being devastated. It just makes me sad.
Well, and it really comes down to it, there's something called housing insecurity.
Right.
And that's, you know, critical. When a family is not comfortable that they're able to provide shelter, that they're moving constantly from one rental to another, there isn't the stability that home ownership does actually provide. When children are able to, you know, go through the same school system with the same family, and they feel comfortable in the neighborhood that they are growing up in and not moving from neighborhood to neighborhood, the stability for the family is just phenomenal. And our experience is that the family thrives. And then the other issue that you just mentioned is it is a vehicle for wealth production. And I don't know if all of you are kind of familiar with the most important thing in real estate and just in, you know, upward mobility is what your zip code is. And owning a home is that first step to changing your zip code. And it's critical, I think. So thanks for bringing that up.
Well, and you and I know it's very telling in what you just said, very, very telling, because the zip code you live in is a predictor for your family, for being victims of crime or being involved in crime. I mean, there are so many variables involved in where you live. And the unaffordability is that, you know what, crazy right now. And James and I have talked about it over and over. If we were a young couple starting out, we would not be able to afford a house. I mean, because there's the other part of it. The wages have not really, the high cost of housing has not been kept up with by the median household income. And I think the report said, I remember reading 8 years in a row. So it's not like everybody's right. Getting these big, you know, humongous raises. So it's keeping up. But the houses in the Tucson market, they're crazy. But when you talk to people in LA and Boston and San Francisco and Denver, it's like almost made up. It sounds like fiction. So I'm sure
it is crazy.
It is crazy. And I'm sure the 2020 report is not going to be the harbinger of really great news, because look what happened in 2020. This is a 2019 report. So
right. And actually, in my mind, I think everything's gotten much worse since that point that this actual article and report was produced.
No doubt.
In terms of the gap getting wider and wider.
Yep. And just another thing, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I watched this report with my daughter a couple of weeks ago about the things that are solved when people get a home. And they did a specific report on veterans in terms of the increase in their mental health, their increase in the ability to work and hold a job, their increase in consistency in showing up for work, children going to school. I mean, it is a ripple effect that if this country invested in it, we would save money. It is really and truly that black and white. Mental health visits go down, drug use goes down, all because of having a safe place to live. And that's what you're all about. So, I mean, I could wax poetic, you know that.
Yeah, you can.
Again, I mean, I believe in it. And I love that you say we give people a hand up, not a handout. And I've seen it. So let's talk for a little bit about the growing racial disparities. And again, this is a case where if it doesn't get better, we all lose. We lose the social capital, the contributions of minorities. So what did the report have to say about racial disparities?
Well, and again, the microscope becomes even bigger at this point, even after this was done, because of the pandemic again.
Right.
Because
right.
It just becomes... because actually, it is the lowest income people that were affected more significantly by
right.
the pandemic.
Right.
So the people who already were struggling, you know, add another struggle. Higher income people really weren't as significantly affected financially by the pandemic, but. People that are already spending 30 to 50% of their income on their housing, when they lose their income, obviously it makes it much worse. Now, a lot of them did get help along the way, but I think there was a long time when we were waiting for stimulus money to come in where, you know, it was just incredibly hard for people to make ways. And it's not just, you know, they did finally catch up, but the stress involved in being behind and not being able to make your payments and not knowing whether you're going to be able to stay in your home is tremendous.
It's terrifying.
And unfortunately, you know, this hit Hispanic, Black, and Asian households much stronger than it did white households. I mean, the figures they come up with are incredible. Whereas, you know, over the years, white household ownership increased to 73.3% in 2019. Black household remained flat, and Hispanic was at 46.6%, and Asian households were at 57.3% in terms of just being able to afford housing.
Yeah, the disparity just continues among minorities. And again, nobody wins in that scenario. These are our lives who have substance and purpose and experiences and the ability to contribute to the community. And if we're taking away that, it's just, you know, I don't want to be Debbie Downer, but it's, to me, when I get this information, it's more about what can we do? And that's always my call on the show, is what can we do about it? What little things can we do to make a difference? And it also, it's hurting renters. And so it's so pervasive, in my opinion. And of course, with that, people of color typically live in areas with concentrated poverty. So getting out, and like you said, changing that zip code, which is really so sad, is really more of a challenge because you're surrounded by crime. There's not as many services. I can tell you this, there's not as many grocery stores that sell organic produce, all the things that matter to the health and well-being of families. So that's pretty
You're
bad.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and nearly two-thirds of low-income Black, Hispanic, and Native American individuals live in high poverty areas compared to one-third of low-income white individuals. And I mean, again, we're talking zip codes still. And it really... it really shows where the issues are here.
And you can't help but think, Gordon, I don't mean to interrupt, but you can't help but think, this is a 2019 report. It's a massive report. It's Harvard, okay? They do everything right and big and grand and accurate, most for the most part. And what's it going to look like for 2020? You think you're going to read about gaps narrowing with minorities and the racial distance, you know, disparities? I don't think so. I think it's going to be, I'll have you on when it comes back and we'll say, okay, Gordon, is there any good news in this damn report? Because it's really hard.
Yeah, no, it's an enormous report. This is 55 pages. Oh. And I think the next one that comes out, unfortunately, is going to tell us a much worse story than this one.
And, you know, the thing is, though, I've got to be hopeful because I really try to read good news, cross my heart. And there is some early reporting about how the relief packages literally saved lives. They saved people from being homeless, from being thrown out of their apartments, from having to lose their homes. So the help that we got, even for us and our family, because we lost some sponsors, it was really needed, and it kept things going, and I didn't have to lay anybody off. And so that's part of the good news. And I don't know about you, I don't think everything is gone back to normal at this point. I think there's still going to be ripple effects, but at least there was relief that mitigated some really severe crises. I believe that. But let's go back to something you mentioned a little bit, and if you can elaborate on it, I love it. Like, there's a whole movement in this country addressing food insecurity and the slow food movement and food deserts. And I will tell you that I haven't heard, I've thought about it, but the phrase together of housing insecurity, which is just awful. What kind of protections are there? What's going on with widespread housing insecurity? Because it affects your mental health.
You're right. And you know, it's I kind of jumped the gun when I talked about it earlier. I mean, it is our third point here, but it's just so much a part of the whole story that sometimes it's hard to keep our 4 points separate because they're really
it's one together. Big ball of wax. It absolutely is.
And, you know, housing insecurity is just, I mean, it's not just in home ownership. Certainly it is in renting and probably even more pervasive in renting. And we all know, too, that the homeless population has increased significantly during this time. So right. You talk about housing insecurity, you know, people that were renting that are now on the street, it's just a significant problem.
And in that show that I watched, I mean, I remember this one man who could have been, I would like to say my dad, but probably me now, because I still think of myself as 40 years old. But
me too.
Seriously, it's like, oh, it could have been my dad, but no, it could have been me, who talked about he was homeless and he had a job his whole entire life, never was on any assistance programs. And he had his legs just knocked out from under him because most people don't have 6 month savings. Let's be honest. Come on. In this world, when a loaf of bread can be $3. And he just said, Gordon, it was so hard for me to watch. He said, I never saw myself as homeless. And it just hit. And it was a pandemic. There were no jobs. You know, he lost his job and he didn't get enough through any of the support programs. And it just broke my heart. It could be anybody. That right. is just your neighbor. I mean, it's so pervasive. So I just feel as though even though there were protections put in, it wasn't enough. And one day I got in my judgment role, you know, how come these renters, landlords aren't giving them a break? And one of my daughters said, Mom, they probably have mortgages that they have to pay too. So it's not a blame game. It's how can we as a community start right. looking at this. So what are some of the biggest barriers to home ownership? That's another point of the report. What are some of the biggest ones?
Well, there are actually a ton of them. A lot of it is knowledge. And I think there's it's funny. There's, you know, Habitat homeowners are, for the most part, generally, they are the first person in their family to ever own a home.
Right.
And there's this culture in people that have never owned a home that believes they can't own a home. They for one, I don't think they really understand all the mechanisms involved. They hear words like down payment, which just scares them.
Right. They're living,
you know,
paycheck
and when
paycheck.
We do talk about people that are hand to mouth, you know, trying to get together a down payment, which, you know, on like an FHA loan is a minimum of 3.5% of the
right
of the sales price. That's a lot of money for somebody who's living hand to mouth or who is, you know, just lost their job. And even for someone renting, they need, you know, first month's and last month's rent and security deposit if they're moving. It just becomes, these are barriers to any type of housing. But when we're talking about home ownership, it comes down to, I think, knowledge, income. And I think there's also the fear of not being able to make the mortgage payment.
Right.
Now,
right.
You know, that's been true for so long. But the lower interest rates today make that certainly much more affordable. And in the case of a Habitat homeowner who, you know, Habitat provides a no interest loan to the homeowner. So it's not as bad as it was when you and I were growing up.
Right, right.
I remember my first mortgage was at, I think, 12%.
I don't remember what ours was, but I know our house payment was $246 a month. And I mean, that just tells you how old I am. And you know, it's to me, it's all of those skill sets and fears that need to be assuaged to get people
correct
in the mindset of maybe it is a possibility. And there are organizations out there that do help. I mean, I love Community Investment Corporation. I know you do too. And they're not doing right. They're not doing loans for homes, but they're helping people with their businesses and doing low or no interest loans to people that would just be redlined automatically because of their color and their station and probably their zip code. Let's be honest, Gordon. Let's just call it what it is.
No, you're right.
It's really true. And another
there really are a ton of organizations out there that do help teach homeowner education to people.
Yes.
I mean, Habitat does it with their homeowners specifically so that they understand our program and how to manage kind of not only their mortgage payment, but their whole budget. And I think that's an important part of it. And I think it's something that Habitat has done more recently than they used to. You know, there's more to it than just making a mortgage payment, because then you obviously will have other payments as well, and you have to be able to balance them all and make sure that you can pay them all and that you can afford your whole package rather than just one or two of your payments.
Well, and it's one of the things that I have such admiration and respect for about Habitat in general. You give people the tools to succeed is the way I would put it. Because
well,
a lot
you.
Of the people, and it's the truth, it's like I'm not, you know, blowing smoke here. A lot of these people never had to pay utility because they're renting motel
right.
rooms. That was one of the biggest shocks to me about 20 years ago when I was working with kids from CE Rose, that their parents, you know, they would move or they would get evicted and they'd stay in motel rooms. So you teach about all of the household things that need to be taught when the home is actually yours. So I think
right.
that's a critical part. It's helping them succeed.
It's kind of, they have to make a cultural shift because if you're a first-time homeowner and you've always rented before, you're used to having a landlord.
to call
and
for
the
everything.
Landlord's
yeah.
pretty, you know, you call the landlord when something breaks.
Right.
And, you know, we try to stress in the very beginning, you know, the responsibilities of being a homeowner. And these are things that you have to do. And, you know, it takes a little while with some of the homeowners. We're the builder too, so they call us up and say, you know, the light bulb went out, and we'll say, well, you know, you'll have to go to the store.
You'll have to go to the store
and get another
it.
Light bulb, or you need to change the filter on your air conditioner. Things like that, that you know, they're used to having somebody else handle. That kind of ties into that barrier of homeownership. I think it's
yes.
just a cultural shift that you need to make.
Yes, you can't just give them a house. You have to give them an opportunity to succeed in education. I was thrilled when I was going through the show notes, and I don't know who did this, but Laura, love her, maybe. I'd love her, yes for sure.
Yes,
but,
it is Laura.
Okay, she's so great. Would to God everybody had someone that does such great show preparation for me, and then I do my own reading and research, but she gives me all the bells and whistles. I'm really happy that she talked about the devastating effects of climate change. And I don't want to, like, that sounds really sick, but I think everybody should be talking about it all the time, every day, because the sky really is falling. And you know, I believe that. Things are not getting a lot better in that area. So what did the report have to say about the effects of climate change? More devastating news. And then we'll get on to some good news, I'm sure.
Well, and I would just like, you know, Laura's going to be listening later, so thank you, Laura, for bringing all this up.
I just want to do the happy dance. She is so great to work with.
we all know, you know, climate change has really changed a lot of things as far as, heat is gone up. Air conditioning goes up when the heat levels go up, and then we've had these forest fires. We've had floods, things that clearly we've always had, but they seem to occur at a much higher pace right now because of climate change. And all these things affect housing. They certainly, the floods and the fires have incredibly affected the cost of construction materials. I mean, to give you one idea, and my colleague, who is our production, chief of production, told me that in between, let's see, fall 2020 to May of 2021, lumber costs have tripled.
Oh, I had no idea it was that bad. Oh, that, like,
he sent me this picture the other day of a stack of 2x4s, and it was, you know, this is the size of $1,000 worth of lumber in, fall of 2020, and this is the size of that same $1,000 stack of lumber in May of 2021, and you laugh.
You should send those pictures to Kelly so that we can put them on the show notes, because that, I mean, okay, a picture is worth 1,000 words. I mean, that's unbelievable, like unbelievable. And it's things that people don't think about. I like to think of myself as a consciously living human being. You know, I'm on the cutting edge of consciousness, right? And I don't think about that.
Devastating. That cost, it also had to do with the pandemic and kind of supply chain problems, but certainly it was exacerbated by everything that's gone on in the environment.
So much so. And I mean, I have a little story. When things come home to nest, to roost or whatever, my daughter and her husband, he's in the Forest Service, and he got an internship in a place called Happy Camp. And, you know, I have this little granddaughter that I talk about all the time and I adore and I want to spend more time with. So we were hoping to rent someplace up there this summer. And I started 5 months ago trying to find a place. And Gordon, there is nothing. And when I say nothing, this is a rabid grandmother on the lookout for a place.
I know you.
You know me.
You're going to find it.
I'm going to find it. I am digging. And one woman finally said to me, she said, Gina, there's nothing here, like nothing. And the reason is, in that area of California, it got devastated by the fire last year. Half of their forest burned. It displaced so many people. And again, when you talked about your point about, you know, these are four separate points, no, they're not. There are five or six or seven all integrated into one devastating impact. And my daughter and son-in-law went there with the baby in a 19-foot RV planning to rent. There is nothing to rent, and there's no places to rent in the RV parks because the tribe up there bought 250 RVs and gave them to families that were displaced that had no place to live. So I
said, wow, I hadn't heard
seriously,
that.
Seriously, Nora. That's great. Gordon, I called this woman. I said, well, what about if we rent an RV for a week? And she said, honey, there's nothing here unless I can convince my boss to go away for a week and then you can have his spot. But my point in saying this is personal. It's also to talk about the continuous ripple devastating effect of these forest fires. We just go away because there's none in my neighborhood, but the living beings that are impacted, and again, to your point, the great divide, the racial disparity and inequity just grows. It just grows. So, so knowing what you know, having done what you've done for so many years, were there any big reveals in this report or any glaring omissions that you think we should talk about, especially as it relates to the Tucson market? What was your overall reaction?
Well, so as it relates to the Tucson market, and it, one of the most critical things of this whole report, as we've already mentioned, is that income has not risen at the same speed as the cost of housing. And that's that gap continues to get larger and larger. And to give you an example, Habitat has recently been putting together some data on our home production over the last 5 years. So in 2016, it cost us $129,000 to build a home. And those houses back then were appraising, and we were selling them for about $127,000.
Okay.
Here we are in 2021. We are now, it costs us now to build the same house, and it's not exactly the same house. Back in 2016, we were building a house with a one-car garage. We are now building a house with a two-car garage. And that was pretty much of a response to the amount of, in Tucson, Arizona, the amount of cars that a family will own.
Right.
It was just crazy. You know, people were parking in the front yard and things. And it just is, as in terms of providing a house that was competitive with the rest of the market, we felt we had to go to a two-car garage. But that's really the only major change in our house. Houses today cost us to build, and this includes the land, all of the infrastructure that goes into the land, and then obviously the cost of construction. And keep in mind, we're doing a lot of this construction with volunteer labor. It costs us $210,000 to build the same house.
Jeez.
Now, that house is actually appraising because of the Tucson market now at $231,000. But when we're talking about affordable housing, That's a big jump, you know, $100,000 in 5 years. And so when you superimpose that $100,000 increase on there, and keep in mind that the Habitat tries to keep their costs as low as they can because it's supposed to be affordable housing, right? But when you look at the household income, the median household income in Tucson, Arizona, in 2016, it was $50,569. And today, in 2021, it is $53,517.
Okay.
So it's increased at the same time that Habitat House has increased $100,000, the income has gone up $3,000.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's just, it's mind boggling. And I want to talk a little bit about, like, we could go on and on and on about the importance of getting people to own their houses and doing anything we can to support it. We all win when that happens. That's what I want to, I get so upset when people think that's a progressive thought. It isn't. It's a very fiscally conservative thought. I beg to differ, because if people own houses, they are helping to build a stronger community. There are all the benefits to the community. So it's in everybody's best interest to make more taxpayers. And to me, it's like, absolutely, let's do it. I mean, that is. I get accused of being a progressive. That's a very fiscally conservative and sound approach. What about, let's end this on a really happy note, because if you can't be the poster child for what we can do about it in terms of supporting Habitat for Humanity anywhere that anyone is listening to in the country here or the world, what can we do? What for our listeners, and we have many, and they're wonderful, and they're involved in the communities. What is your call to action? You can say as many as you want. I'm already a call to action involved with Habitat.
So boy, you know, I mean, obviously, you can donate to Habitat, you can volunteer with Habitat, but I think there's some more important things that we need to do, you know, nationally and locally. As far as, I think we need to advocate with our leaders that they look into zoning, they look into, you know, ways that will make it easier for affordable home builders to build homes. Because as you say, Gina, everybody wins.
Everybody
when we have
wins.
More home ownership. You know, it actually, us building Habitat has built. I think now we're up to about 475,000 houses. I'm sorry, 475 houses in Tucson.
I was going to say, that's really good. I wasn't aware of that. But 470.
We're up there with the KBs and,
just call me Don Diamond.
Right. Yeah. No, but I mean, that's, you know, we've built a significant amount of homes and brought a bunch of homeowners into the market. A lot of them have bought up from there. A lot of them have built a good deal of equity, particularly now where, you know, we're seeing a lot of our homeowners have a good deal of equity in their homes, and we're really excited about that, because that's really the American dream, that finally being able to participate in.
Yes, getting a seat at the table. And so I'm thrilled that you brought that up, because I'm very involved with Local First and their initiatives. And we had a call last week with the Environmental Defense Fund, which is really focusing on Arizona. And Gordon, the whole conversation with leaders from around the city was about the need for more activism in the policy area. And we're on committees, and I don't know how many people know, but if you get 10 phone calls and you're an elected representative, you start paying attention. Your staff starts paying attention. And I think for me, it's one of the hardest things to do. I'm getting better at it because I think the needs are so great. But we all that have the means and the acumen and the knowledge and experience and the confidence, we need to start talking to our local, regional, and federal representatives about a national housing agenda. To me, it is so important, and everybody wins.
You're right. And so historically, you know, housing policy has changed in a reactive fashion. There never has been an overarching housing policy that was forward looking. Housing always seems to be a new policy comes up that's a reaction to something that happened in the past or a historical real estate market or something. It's not, and you know, this is part of the problem is obviously because administrations change every 4 to 8 years. But
we can have a local impact.
There is long-term plan.
No, there's no long plan.
That's a sad part.
And we can think globally and act locally. And I sometimes think I sound goofy because I'm so incredibly impressed with the work of Habitat, but I was in social services for 35 years, so I got to see the magic happen. And as you know, we do a Chapman Cares home build every year. That's right. A local auto dealership here in Tucson. And then they did a Brush with Kindness, which is another program you have that helps people that are elderly. And I'm always making a joke now. I'm saying define elderly, over 90, right? But there are people my age that have physical disabilities and have lost a spouse or whatever. And this is what I want to say to the listeners from my heart. There's something you can do with Habitat that will make you feel so good about your contribution. I was going through, we're moving, personally moving our house, and I have my, you know, my collection of t-shirts, and I was very happily surprised at all the ones I have from the home builds every year.
Yes.
And I never wear the same one. I'm going to start doing that. As Mrs. Green, I'm going to start wearing repeats and not taking a new t-shirt. But it's, you can go, and if you don't have any money, you can show up as a volunteer and paint or move rocks or, you know, there's a million things. If you want to do Brush with Kindness, you can help somebody clean up their yard and remove debris. So it's not just about money. It's about sweat equity. And I want to underscore what I said. It makes you feel so good. That's not necessarily the reason you should do it. But, you know, you go and you think, I'm doing this really great thing for my community. And then I get in the car and I think, what's that all about? I feel so good and so proud. The rewards are you know, hard to articulate. So, and there's Habitats all over for this show.
Well, thank you, Gina.
And you know, I mean it. It's like I show up at home builds. I show up at the woman's build. I support a little bit financially, but you can do a tax credit. So I don't want to make this a commercial for Habitat. I want to make it an informed plea for if you want to do something to invest in your community that has a great ROI, I would take a hard look at Habitat around the world. I mean, seriously.
Well, thank you. And you know, I just have to warn anybody that hasn't done it before and is thinking about it, be careful because 30 years ago was when I started. I walked out on the site and, you know,
it gets you.
I've been sucked in for the last 30 years.
I know.
So be careful.
I made a joke about the thing that wouldn't leave, but it becomes something that becomes part of your DNA. And
absolutely.
He and I have talked about it a lot. It's just, it makes sense from every level. And I want to tell you just a funny story. When I interviewed John from Bangladesh, I don't remember his last name,
right.
I remember his first name. And I'll never forget this. It was one of the times where I don't think I shined very much, but I said to him, John, I have to ask this question. Bangladesh, and the housing conditions there are beyond my ability to even comprehend. And I asked him if they had toilets in the house, and he was very respectful and very nice. And I mean, it speaks well. And he said, Gina, no, they don't. It's like,
well, yeah, that's, you know, Bangladesh Habitat is really more concerned with helping people in the area with actually infrastructure,
yes,
more than actually building houses.
Yes.
I mean, they're trying to provide sanitation and clean water. Forget the house, you know,
they're just trying to give
them some of those things that we all take for granted.
Oh my gosh, Gordon, you're so right. It's just, well, anyway, I guess at some point we have to wrap up. This has been delightful. I love having my own studio so that there's nobody telling me we have to hurry up and get over with, because I wanted to cover all of these things, and I want you to give my best to all of the wonderful, amazing people that you have there, and I've gotten to know many of them. And just my last word to everybody listening, if ever there was a time that the world needs you, this is it. If you're listening to a podcast, you're a part of a demographic. And that's all I can say. And you can be part of making a difference. And it doesn't have to be Habitat. There are so many needs out there now more than ever in my lifetime. And that's the truth. I mean, this pandemic really took a toll and it's not over. So just think of some little extra thing you can do to just up your game. That's my plea, Gordon.
Well, thank you, Gina. And thank you, you know, we Habitat really enjoys being one of your sponsors. But, you know, more than that, I want to thank you personally for, you know, your commitment to the environment and to Tucson, Arizona, and the whole world.
That's really nice.
For what you do as well.
Really nice. Really nice. Okay. Take care, my good friend, and everybody go out there and make a difference. Make it a great green day. Make it a great green living day. And I guarantee you, if you haven't done it, you'll be sending me an email saying, you're right, it felt so good. Okay. Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you, Gina.
Thanks, Dave, our sound engineer, for always making the magic work. I don't thank him enough. I don't thank Kelly enough for lining everybody up when it's not always easy. I have an attitude of gratitude for my team, all of them. They're all there to make my life work and to produce something that I think is outstanding. So thank you, one and all. And Gordon, thank you. Take good care of yourself.
You too.